gentlemen, it's time for Forge the Narrative.
Hey everybody, welcome to Forge the Narrative. My name is Paul Murphy, your host. We all about Lost Souls podcast. I'm joined tonight by Justin Troop and Chris Morgan.
What up?
How now, Brown Town?
And Ricky Addington.
Did you guys hear that America is getting Space Marines?
What's not? It's a weird situation. It's weird over here right now for people that are out there in the world. It's a little weird over here. So this is episode 231. This might be a really long episode. We're going to try some new things this week. Since we have so much content, we're going to see how it all goes down.
And I think we should do it as a very special episode, Paul, where one of us becomes addicted to some sort of medication that helps us like study harder, and then we fall apart right at the end, and then our parents come in and has, you know, nice inspiring music.
Would that be at the next episode where one of us gets off the smack, or do we resolve that within the span of this hour?
I offer myself as tribute. That's all I know.
I think it's a two-parter in which Troop gets addicted to some sort of performance-enhancing drugs.
Something that helps him read. Game.
Yeah.
we won't call it the limitless pill due to, you know, copyright infringement and whatnot.
I'll just take less limit pills.
Well, this week I'm getting ready for the Adepticon team tournament coming up at the end of next week, which it's coming up really soon. Adepticon, I mean, it's 4,000 people. You know, we had Matthias Weeks on. We've talked to other folks from that tournament in the past. It's a truly epic experience. Put it on your list of things to do. Getting ready for that. I'm painting. I have two more tanks to paint, and then I'm sending them off to the team. Someone else is transporting them there. It's a fun time. It really is.
I mean, for just a little local store tournament, Adepticon is a lot of fun. They pack a lot in there, you know?
4,000 people into your... That hotel
is a small RTG.
Massive. And they've already... they're exceeding the capacity of that hotel. Like, if you hear the interview from a couple episodes back... Like, it's truly, it is a spectacle. I mean, it really is the closest thing that our hobby has to a convention. And I mean, like, a full-on convention where panels, side activities, you know, the
gigantic vendor hall, Comic-Con style.
I was trying to persuade one of our buddies to go with us, and he's like, "Yeah, I was thinking about going, but I don't know." You know, I was like, and I was trying to explain Adepticon to him, and it just kind of devolved into a lot of, "Dude, you don't even know."
Yeah,
and it was just me saying that a lot.
Yeah, until someone goes and sees just the volume of people and people milling about, like people off doing their own thing that you will never interact with. And that's not in a bad way. They're off having a blast. They just, it's never going to involve you.
Oh man. Like, yeah, I wormed my way into a room and they were all playing that Batman miniatures game, and you only have like five or six models to your army or whatever you call it in that game. So everybody that plays that game takes all this extra time for those five little models. Like, you know, the time we spend on, you know, 100 models, they're spending on five. So their models are insane. And every one of them.
You mean hobby-wise, not like decision-making. You mean.
Right. Hobby-wise. Like, so every one of you walk in there, every one of them is like this like showpiece. And they had these, everybody had these like thematic displays and everything for their little gang. So like you'd have like Batman, Robin, and they'd be on these cool little displays. And it kind of put a lot of my stuff to shame, dude. I was really impressed with that.
That's
so
pretty cool. That dedication is neat.
Yeah, it's fun to go check out those games that aren't as, because like 40K, Warhammer kind of dwarfs so many other really neat games out there. And it's one of those things where it's like there's really cool games out there, but if you can't get the people in your area to play them, you'll never play them, right? Because you won't have an opponent.
Well, that's one of the cool things about Adepticon is that you can go
exactly,
and you will have
a
host of opponents.
Exactly. Like things it might only be you and your buddy here. Like I can only get me and two of my friends to play Drop Fleet Commander. But when you go to these bigger events, you see 100 people there.
I'm bringing a couple of side games just to play as pickup things. I mean, like not even miniature related. I'm bringing a couple
of Warhammer know, Paul, that you have a side chick?
Warhammer's the wife. All right. Age of Sigmar's the girlfriend. And then it spawns out from there. 40K is the wife.
Yeah. The coolest thing about Adepticon, in my opinion, unfortunately, I never get to go due to work constraints. That's like a kind of a blackout period for us. Unfortunately, I did get to go, 2 years back.
It was a blackout period for me too.
Well, yeah, it was a different blackout period for you.
I came home with a Warlord Titan.
Got it.
But you know, while you're there friend. though, every, you're getting to meet like all these people, you know, everybody watches every YouTube video, everybody listens to every podcast, and you get to meet everybody, you know, while you're there and really, you know, interact in a different way. I remember one of the nights we were there, me and Paul were walking and, you know, just, it was person after person. And we just, you know, stopped and, hey man, you know, awesome. Love your stuff. Hey man, love your stuff. And, you know, it was like this back and forth thing. It took us like 30 minutes to get back to the convention hall almost.
Cause it's a mile between the elevators and the,
well, that too. Yeah.
That is true. Yeah.
And I did,
but that's a good thing.
Every alcohol cart that was on the way, but you know, whatever. Need
a shuttle between the elevators and the hall.
I'm jazzed. I got these back on topic. I got these two tanks to paint. I've got the weathering process, and I've had. We should just title this segment like my hobby failures.
That could be a whole podcast. We could do a whole podcast of our failures.
Oh, I know I've got a limited time to finish painting these models, and I sit down and the airbrush clogs. It's like everything that could go wrong absolutely has gone wrong with getting the stuff on. So I've got everything mostly ready to go, and I've got the airbrush sitting in some solvent right now to clean it out.
Well, just borrow Chris's. I mean, it's brand new.
Brand spanking new. Never been touched. Yeah,
yeah, it's like new in box.
I should know. I'll get this done.
I will have it done and sent
out by Saturday and be ready to go next week for the tournament. This is part of it. Like, I'm not stressed about painting. I really enjoy how things are coming out. Like, I've painted like 8 tanks or something, several demon princes and stuff. And I'm also working on a buddy of mine's figures for a completely different game that he uses for his role playing game, and that's spawned the finishing moves. We're going to talk about painting Ghost in the finishing moves segment on this podcast.
Sounds ethereal.
That's coming later. So if you're listening to this right now, you're going to hear our Tau coverage. The Tau, what we tried to do is kind of frame like how you can actually use them in your game. I think the trend with some of these codexes is that when they come out, if they don't have double shooting Dark Reapers, then people kind of get a little sour.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of people like the past couple of codexes. It seems like they come out and people are like, yeah, it's okay.
That's the exact same way people felt about the Eldar. That's the exact same people felt about every single codex, because like it takes a little while for this stuff to marinate and for you to find like I know that there is something in that Tau codex that's going to dominate whatever your local meta is, and it's throwing something else into the pool that will have to be worked around.
Best bit.
Well, I think the thing, you know, that we see there is that you know, everybody is expecting that creep like we used to see in the old books, and they're, you know, expecting, well, this book's coming out, so what is that just broken thing that, you know, it seemed like we saw every time a book came out in 7th, and now all of a sudden every book comes out and it's like, oh wow, okay, no, it seems like this is right on par with the other books, and all the books seem to really kind of stay pretty close together, except Unari, and that's Index. So
I'm looking forward to how it shakes out. We talked about, like, I like the big super suits. I like the way they look, and I think there's play for them. And we also talked about including stuff in the Forge World stuff, and we get a little grief for talking about Forge World stuff. They're like, why don't you just focus on the codex? Like, you can't, like, the time for this not being a whole package, considering as a whole package, is well dead and gone. Like, you got to look at it the whole way. Like, let your local environment may not play with Forge World, but that is the minority right now.
Yeah, we had a new person come to one of our tournaments, and he wrote me a message. He's, hey, is Forge World allowed? Is that okay? And I was like, are you playing somewhere that it's not? Like, and I was really surprised. And I'm not trying to be like a smart aleck towards those who still don't allow it or anything, but you know, we used to really pride ourselves on, in our area, that we allowed Forge World. You know, like, we're like, yes, it's a great model, bring it. You know, we'll deal with it. Who cares? Bring it. Play with the models that are in the game. And now all of a sudden, you know, over the past 2 years or something, how it's shifted to like, really, you don't allow it? So that's how far we've come.
It's a wonderful time to be gaming.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
I fully believe that.
Well, it's accessibility. The Forge World stuff it's not as hard to get as it used to be. You know, back in the day, you know, you had to get it from Forge World and Forge World only. Well, now with GW traveling to the U.S. in multiple venues, you're able to buy Forge World right here, you know, picking up resin in America. That's a big deal, you know, and you're getting these the books and you're getting the models.
Well, just with the internet too, like it used to be hard to track where which book. Like I found an interview with myself that someone interviewed me in text before the show started. So this is back in like late 2012, 2013 kind of thing. And I specifically stated back then that it was hard to keep up with Forge World because you couldn't tell if you were ever playing with the right version of the rules.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's not the case anymore. And that was my only real objection to it 5-6 years ago, was that it seemed like the popular models kept getting new rules and new like small books. And now that's not the case anymore. Now we're getting much more predictable releases where we know where the rules are.
Yeah, it used to just be one of those things that was like... I felt like it was kind of in the army sometimes. We'll pull out a manual for a piece of equipment and we'll try to reference something, and then it'll reference us to another thing and then another thing. And then we went through three books trying to get to one thing. And that's kind of how the old Forge World.
That's like,
it's not in that book. No, is it Imperial Armor this, Revised this? Was it in, you know, there were so many books
out there.
That's not
the case anymore.
Now it's great.
Yeah. So we did get some news from Gamma today, and a neat thing, my local store actually won an award as one of the top gaming store retailers in the country, Gigabytes Cafe.
I hear they're a big deal. They seem okay.
No, I'm like proud by proxy. Like runs it. I mean, he's a friend of the show, and it's a great store. Like, it is an awesome environment, and that translates, that comes down from the guy that owns it to all the employees. It's an amazing environment. It's a giant store too, many, many play tables, which is uncommon in areas like when we have tournaments and people show up that like come in from Alabama or Florida. They're like, holy smokes, we've got like three tables at our store and run 9-man tournaments, and this is
on a good day.
And that's the most we're ever gonna have. And like, this is so I'm happy to have that environment, and it's cool that they got recognized in that area. But we also, on the Games Workshop seminar side of things, which this has hit the internet, we saw some really cool terrain from the Kill Team set that's coming out.
I was more excited by the terrain than I was about Kill Team.
That terrain. Now look, Kill Team's going to be, it's going to be a skirmish level. We don't deal with the 40K, like the skirmish side. We deal with Necromunda and we deal with Blood Bowl and other games, you know, in Shadespire, like the skirmish game. We're all about skirmish games. But for us, like when we're moving our 40K models around, we're typically talking about like 40K.
Yeah.
Like the, you know, again, the wife, everything else is the girlfriend or whatever.
Yeah. Kill Team is great. You know, I love that. It's great if you only got half an hour or an hour or whatever to move some models around real quick. But man, I've got so many other games to play right now.
Kill Team and Necromunda and, you know, in Shadow War, again, there's lots of different ways to scratch that itch. And as a hobby, like as someone who likes to build models and paint models, like I easily see myself building, you know, like this Harlequin Force that's my hobby project for this year. Like I could build that towards some of these skirmish levels and feel like I'm accomplishing something.
Yeah, that's true. That's a good point. Like there's, 100%. Like Harlequins are a great example because I could see myself putting together 10 of those, but a whole army of Harlequins, I think I would probably go into some sort of shock or something and just like fall into the floor drooling.
Little lights.
Yeah. That may be the way to go.
So that Kill Team terrain that they didn't even talk about it in the video. Like, that's no, all. I could not look at it.
Yeah.
Did you guys also notice something else interesting about the Kill Team video?
I just kept looking at the terrain.
There was a D8 on the table.
What?
Yeah.
Hold on, I'm going back and watching this while you talk.
Yep, exactly.
2 seconds in.
Our dice are being advanced ahead of the D6, and I blame Belisarius Call for his meddling with the gene seed of our dice. He's adding two more sides to them, and I'm not sure how I feel about that.
The 8 sides represent the 8 loyal legions, Chris.
Or his 8 wounds. There were 9 loyal legions.
No, there weren't.
Ooh, that's a Dark Angels joke, Ricky. How do you feel about that?
I hate you, guys.
Oh, the slow burn. I'm so good at this.
And I even stood up for you, man. Like, there's 9.
I'm kidding. I have no disrespect to our Dark Angel players out there.
Yes, it is. America, that he means it.
I don't actually feel that way. But I was excited to see the Blood Bowl stuff and the Necromunda stuff coming out. Like those kits for the Necromunda gangs, the Vansar look, I mean, we saw just the briefest of teasers, but they look really neat.
Yeah, yeah. Dude, I'm telling you, world, if you are not playing Necromunda and you have not made a gang and started a small campaign and just like play it one night a month, if that's all you can do. But my gosh, that is the most fun that I've had playing a game in so long, because I love a lot of terrain on the table. So Necromunda is great there. But just every time one of your guys gets shot, you actually feel it emotionally. That's where it's exciting, because you're invested in it. And I love it. It's so good.
Even when you're firing your gun, see if it runs out of ammo.
I know. Even rolling to hit is cringeworthy when you've got like a, you know, something with like rare ammo and stuff. I love it, man. That game is great. And if Kill Team can bring a campaign system along with it or anything like that Necromunda has, yeah, I'll be all over it.
I got it. Well, guys, let's jump into the Tau coverage, and we'll take a quick break and come back with these guys. It's going to be a long break as we discuss some of the suits and the strategies of how to incorporate Tau against what the actual like current meta is. And I know people hate it when you use that term, but it is what it is.
It's a fact of life. It's a fact of life.
So we'll jump to that, and then we'll come back and we'll talk about more hobby stuff.
Forged Narrative is brought to you by Dicehead.com. www.dicehead.com. Games, hobby supplies, and comics. They have it all.
Hey everybody, welcome to a special segment of Forge the Narrative. My name is Paul Murphy, your host. I'm joined today by Justin Troop.
The Burst Cannon himself.
And Val Heffelfinger.
Remora Drones.
This is a bonus episode, I believe. I don't think I'll release this as part of the regular show. Wanted to bring some legitimate Tau content. I know that we had kind of a bit of a hurry up on our last show, and I apologize. So my goal is to try to get this out maybe before the show this week comes out. And I kind of want to frame the discussion around, how do you compete in a game where you cannot play in all the phases? You know, what we said, just talking about army list design, when people write in about, hey, how's my army list, or I'm choosing not to do this or that, how can I play, or how can I win? And we say, well, if you're not going to compete in X, Y, or Z phase, you've got to be like doubly or triply that much better in the phases that you can compete in. And so largely giving up the fight phase for the Tau, completely giving up the psychic phase for the Tau, how can they compete? Can they compete effectively enough to compensate for that in the moving and the shooting phase?
And that is the question at hand. I have my personal opinions on this, and I've hated Tau forever, and it's because of their overwhelming shooting, and I've always played assault armies, and they always blew me off the table before I could assault them. And it was annoying. I think that the balancing act that we have in 8 and the changes that we saw in the index brought things in line, now that we have a better point values, of course. So I think that they're going to compete very well in the shooting phase. Are they going to compete enough, though, is a question that I still don't know if I can answer.
Last show, we did talk about how much the like things like the Riptide had dropped in price. You know, it's still, with the Riptide, with the Ion Accelerator and the Smart Missile Systems, you're still looking at, like, what, 280 points or something? But the points that you saved is like a free unit. If you just look at it this way, it's like a free unit of Fire Warriors or some Kroot or whatever. So
best bit.
I'm talking about things that help you win games. Not things.
Oh, okay. We're talking. Okay. But competitive podcast.
It's a complete change, though. I'm sorry. The change you got from what you would have purchased a Riptide, you know, 2 months ago, is now going to get you what could potentially be an objective secured scoring unit with a 30-inch range gun.
True.
Very strong 30-inch range gun.
My bigger question is, I mean, competing in the shooting phase is one thing, but surviving the shooting phase is another. So Riptides obviously have that extra defense provided by, you know, drones that are on the table. I'm curious, did they happen to get back their deep strike mechanic? I might have been napping during the data slate review.
You mean like some way to deep strike in on their own?
Yeah, like other battle suits. Can they do that, or do they have to start on the table?
This starts on the table without some war gear. Like, we've got a couple of questions about, well, can the Riptide move and shoot at full ballistic skill? And the answer is kinda, because you can't normally, but if you buy the multi-tracker, then you can.
Yeah. There are a couple even in the index that were sort of automatic with the Riptide, that being one of them. Can the Riptide take an invulnerable save? Since we saved all those points on the heavy burst.
The Riptide has the shield.
It's got the 5+, and then it goes up to the shield as well. That's right.
Yes. And they can also use the Nova Charge, which they automatically take the mortal wound now instead of the roll. I don't know a Tau player who didn't take the wound, even with the Feel No Pain, every time they used it. I think that was common, it seemed anyway. Just kind of the way the fates would work out.
Heck, I've seen it do more damage than I was able to do to him sometimes.
But the multi-tracker, I'm sorry, it's the target lock. I said multi-tracker before, but the target lock is what you need to be able to move and fire at your full ballistic skill. For Ghost Kills, Riptides, and Storm Surges is 12 points, and for all other models is 6 points. So I think you just tack that on to your Riptide almost as standard, and then you're only looking at 292 points.
That's not too bad. That's quite a shooty unit. It's survivable if it's got a lot of drones around it.
Yeah, and we haven't talked about things like the different SEPs and how that applies too. As you know, there is that SEP that allows you to add range to your weapons. So one, you might not have to move with range on your weapons. That would turn your 36 inch weapon into a 42 inch weapon, and that's a different ballgame.
You can be a lot more stationary and just dump shots downrange. That's for sure. You've also got the traditional Riptide's best pal, especially with that. The extended range really applies, and I don't know if we want to drift off into Index Forge World land, but if it winds up being able to apply to something like Yavara. That might be the only one that you see.
So does the Yavara have a sept keyword you can give it? I imagine it does, but that's what you'd have to look at.
I can confirm that within moments.
And its models with this tenet may add 6 inches to the maximum range of any rapid fire and heavy weapons they are armed with. So it wouldn't be like an assault flamer or something like that. They couldn't add the 6 inches to that.
Oh, I like that they did that, because that could get real dirty with that, the flamer from Forge World.
But the heavy burst cannon is 36 inches and it is heavy 12.
So all of the crazy weapons that a Yavara gets to have are heavy.
Okay.
So that actually, one of my frustrations with the Yavara is that it's got a cool sort of jump back in the sky move that you can do with its Nova reactor. And then it can come back down later. But when it comes back down, its flamer would have been out of range with that sept ability. Now it's able to basically deep strike and be within flamer range, which is pretty awesome.
I like what you just said there.
Yeah.
What's the flamer do?
Oh, my. So if the Nova reactor is fired, well, just standard, which is pretty good. It's heavy 2d6, normally 8 inches, strength 6, -2 AP, 3 damage. Hits automatically. If once you go to a Nova, it's heavy 3d6. And it does have a set, by the way. There is a sub-faction keyword, no doubt. The Yavara is an absolute beast right now. With this additional range, it's actually getting kind of... We'll see how long this lasts.
I mean, if it's only powerful on that... It's not going to only be powerful, but if it's like only grossly overpowered on that one unit, I don't see how that's really a problem.
Well, I mean, you could fix it, you know, doing something like you just said, like make them, instead of being heavy weapons, make them assault weapons.
Well, I'm not
like,
trying to fix
that.
That's
an errata that fixes it.
Look, because really the premise is...
I hope it does. Yeah. Well, I'm not saying this is broken,
by the way. Premise is, okay, this army cannot compete in the assault phase, absolutely cannot compete, can't even deny. There's nothing in this book that I found that even lets you deny a single psychic power on the worst roll. So how do you then compete in the game? Well, you've got to be really great in the other phases. And so I'm cool with them being great in the other phases.
Do they still have the supporting fire thing where you get to chain link the overwatching?
This is called For the Greater Good.
Yeah.
And I believe that's what it was called before, or at least some similarity to that. But when an enemy unit declares a charge, a unit with this ability that is within 6 inches of one of the charging unit's targets may fire overwatch as if they were also targeted. A unit that does so cannot fire overwatch again this turn.
Now, you know, when we're talking about not competing in the assault phase, are we considering this ability, because it is a pretty strong ability, are we not considering that? You know, I know where my opinion lies. I'm asking you guys.
Overwatch is annoying, and when it works, it's like real incredibly depressing to your opponent, because you know they're expecting to really get in there. And there's an ability in here that you get to fire even better if the enemy's within 6 inches of you. So if they're like somebody's lined up a 1-inch charge and you super shoot them or whatever.
Yeah.
See, that's powerful.
Real demoralizing, but still, you need.
Does a Kadra Fireblades like bonus shots apply in Overwatch as well? I think they do.
I think that kind of stuff is anytime it shoots, period. But
right, so like you can have like this massive wall of shots coming in from Overwatch. There's ways to get it up to a 5+ from shooting. The issue with for the greater
good. Read out what it is here.
Sure.
Models incept units within 6 inches of any friendly set Cadre Fireblade may fire an extra shot with pulse pistols, pulse carbines, and pulse rifles when shooting at a target within half the weapon's range.
There you go.
Not in the shooting phase, not anything, just when you're pulling that trigger.
So I don't know if you saw Reese Robbins of Frontline Fame had a really fun Tau infantry list that he posted up today. Worth a look, if not just for its silliness. But it basically just dumps a ton of shots using some of the infantry buffing characters that they have available to them. Just to get to for the greater good there, it's still very good in the sense that you can really focus fire one unit that's coming at you via Overwatch. The issue is that when you do for the greater good, you can only do it once. So you only get to Overwatch once. Whereas, you know, normally in 8th edition, you can Overwatch as many times as you're not engaged, right? And still the target of a charge. So that's sort of one of the give and takes on for the greater good in this edition. And again, I guess a crafty assault opponent might set it up so that you know, they're able to lock you in combat. You don't really have a choice but to Overwatch, even though it might not be the one that you want to. That sort of thing.
It will require a little bit of shenanigans. Well, and it's only that unit can't fire once. Like that, the first target unit can fire its Overwatch the whole time. It's the supporting guys that can only do it once.
Correct.
And so
yeah.
If someone's trying, say you've got a unit of 10 fire warriors or whatever, and somebody's trying to charge it with one gaunt, you know, your odds are good. You don't have to use the greater good.
Correct. Yeah. So you just have to be judicious with it because, you know, it's not like before it's not like other things where you can just keep overwatching until you're doing it.
And that is pretty brutal. But a lot of the assault elements in some of these more power builds we see are things like a blood litter bomb or death company or something like that. There's only that one threat. And right. So using the greater good one time is probably enough.
Correct. And, you know, they're, you know, some of the biggest, I guess, assault threats out there right now. Things like, I guess, Death Company would be, you know, you put enough wounds on a Death Company unit, you're going to kill a bunch of them.
Yeah, their saves.
Just because their saves will let them down, yeah.
Yeah, with the 6+ Feel No Pain, I think we might, if this becomes something that's popular and that's wrecking everybody, we will see transports come back. We will see Rhinos making those charges.
Yeah, I mean, that's already a thing you can do. Yeah. I mean, like, you know, the Berserker's Rhino, if it survives that long, that's what it should be doing.
And let me read this greater good thing one more time to see if there's when an enemy unit declares a charge, a unit with this ability that is within 6 inches of one of the charging unit's targets may fire Overwatch. It says it has nothing to do with if the target unit is already locked in combat. You just keep firing.
That's kind of neat.
If you choose.
So even if the target unit is already locked and occupied, other things can sort of cover its back.
When an enemy unit declares a charge, a unit with this ability that is within 6 inches of one of the charging unit's targets may fire Overwatch as if they were also targeted. A unit that does not or does so cannot fire Overwatch again this turn.
That is very sweet.
I like that. That's pretty baller. That had to have been intentional. I hope it was, at least.
Seems like it. Well, anyway, just again, how to find value, and your question of whether or not that compensates for an entire assault phase. I think there are some rounds it will, and most rounds I'm really hoping it doesn't. as being the one who likes to assault,
right? Yeah, against me, it's going to be crippling.
I will lose to this twice a tournament. There is, I mean. Now that drones got markedly more expensive, you know, people are probably still looking to probably maybe look at Kroot to fill that screen role. And, you know, being 6 inches back from the front line, except for, you know, some of those compounding stratagems people can use to really penetrate deep through the lines. In a lot of cases, 6 inches is going to give you a little bit of safety for that secondary layer. So if you have your screening unit up front to take the charge, then you could have a line of guys able to do for the greater good right behind them who are going to be safe from consolidating and pile in moves, or safe-ish. It'll be tight. Well, so that could be a way to sort of
the crew don't have greater good.
I was going to get to that, but there are ways to get them greater good through, I think, a Sept Doctrine. There is a way. Or maybe a stratagem or a warlord trait. There is something that allows them to take advantage of it. And that's why I was bringing it up. Because if you're using Crude as your screening unit, you're going to want them to have the ability to have your backline, you know, shoot in Overwatch as they're getting
That's eaten. The Daedalith, a warlord trait. Whilst when the 12 inches of your warlord, friendly Crute, and Vespid units gain for the greater good ability.
There you go.
They even include a Vespid, I'm telling you.
So there you go. You make a Crute Shaper your warlord. Go nuts.
I don't know that they can be the warlord. I mean, I don't, maybe they can be. You know.
Their character.
Oh, right. But there's a lot of exclusions about what the like what the warlord or what can be this and can be that. And typically those types of things are left off. Like I know there are a couple things here that Crute cannot be an option for. Like you cannot give a Crute a relic.
Oh, my.
Yeah. But only it's a Tau Empire character. So if a Crute is a Tau Empire character, then let me go to the Crute Carnivores. Crute Shaper. Tau Empire character.
Crute Shaper.
Boom.
He's a Tau Empire character. Maybe so. Look, I haven't gotten into this, can quite explore what the Crute can and cannot do, but it is nice to know that Sept will allow you to nominate that for the Crute. And the Crute do get, is where I was going with this, the Crute Carnivores, they do get the ability to be set up inside enemy lines, essentially at the start of the first battle round. But before the first turn begins, you can move this unit up to 7 inches.
So they have like the Scout Sentinel move, yeah, which and is great. It
cannot move more than within 9 inches of an enemy model.
And I guess to your earlier point, right, like what are ways to mitigate the assault phase? Well, establishing massive bubbles around all your important bits is a good way to do that. Stealth suits. I believe they have like scout, like Space Marine scout style infiltrate, don't they?
The infiltrators. During deployment, this unit and accompanying drones can be set up anywhere on the battlefield that is not within your opponent's deployment zone and is more than 12 inches from any enemy unit.
Right. So like they kind of get overlooked. So you normally you would just think of Nurglings and you would think of Space Marine scouts as being able to do that. But that's a like during deployment into the neutral zone move that they can make. They are pricier than either of those options, obviously, but they're also tougher and they can carry very important things.
Oh, they have so a homing another beacon, and there may be ways to kind of mess around with the homing beacon.
Oh yeah. Now, how have the rules changed on the homing beacon?
The homing beacon or says have they? A homing beacon may be used at the start of your movement phase by placing it within 1 inch of its unit. If there are any friendly homing beacons on the battlefield at the end of your movement phase, one of your Sept units that has been set up in a Manta hold can perform a low altitude drop instead of the Manta strike. Set up the unit wholly within 6 inches of the homing beacon. The homing beacon then shorts out and is removed from the battlefield. Homing beacons are deactivated and removed from the battlefield if any enemy model ends a move within 9 inches of it.
Okay.
So there's a couple things going on right here. The homing beacon is placed 1 inch from the stealth suits. Someone can then teleport down. So at the you place, maybe used at the start of your movement phase by placing it within 1 inch of its unit. So that you place it at 1 inch of the enemy unit. It doesn't say there's an exclusion from where you can bring things down. So if there are any friendly homing beacons on the battlefield at the end of your movement phase, one of your Sept units that has been set up in a Manta hold can perform this low altitude. So if you've got anybody in reserve in a Manta Ray hold or whatever, then they can come down on this beacon within 6 inches of the beacon.
Yeah, and that's how you get you know, your fusion commanders or your, you know, your flamer encrusted crisis suits, you know, within, you know, their range, even though they're deep striking and would normally be outside of 9 inches.
Yeah, and the stealth suits, they're fairly survivable. I mean, they have a 3+ save, but your opponent must subtract one from all hit rolls for attacks that target the unit. And then they can move around and shoot. They have target locks.
Yeah, and you can you can bring them with marker lights. The thing is, they get spendy real fast, but I'm going to butcher the word, Chasvray. So like the sergeant, I think he can carry a marker light, or at least he used to be able to.
He may take a marker light and target lock.
And target lock. So there you go. So like there's So that means he can move and shoot it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's some really awesome options for them. And I mean, just dumping shots out of their burst cannons, pretty cool. And they're tough to root out for your opponent.
The burst cannons are assault 4, strength 5, 18-inch range.
Yep. And if they take any signature systems, you can get a -1 on that. I don't know if they can take signature systems.
They take support systems.
Any
model may take a single item from the support system list. Let me talk about this for a second. The support system list is the list at the front of the army list section. It is not, don't flip to the war gear in the back and pick one of those support systems. And let me tell you why, because I got real excited when I was on the first read through of this, because the Storm Surge says it can take support systems. And I go back there and there's the X something or whatever, Crisis Iridium suit, 2+ armor save is what it is.
That's a really big Iridium suit.
Like I would, but you know, that would have been awesome, but they can't. No, you go to the support on page 89 of the codex. There's a range weapon and support system charts, just like it is in the other codexes, of what you can actually pick for your things when it says you get something from this option.
Anything significant, like any changes to the support system? Anything not there that used to be there?
The early warning override, let's talk about that for a second. If enemy units are set up within 12 inches of the model from an army equipped with an early warning override, it is a result of an ability that allows them to arrive mid-battle. Then at the end of the phase, the model may immediately shoot at one of those units as if it were your shooting phase, but you must subtract 1 from hit rolls when resolving these shots.
Interesting.
So it's like an intercept, but it's only 12 inches. And so before, I believe in the previous edition, maybe not in the index, but in the previous edition, it was board wide.
Oh, yeah, for sure. It was just if you had line of sight, you could do it. One thing, though, like I remember when the indexes came out and obviously we were fresh out of 7th, I believe the parlance is butthurt about the fact that early warning override wasn't board wide and had that sort of Kotiaz style bubble. But if one of the biggest threats you have is stuff coming out of Deep Strike and charging you and eating you, then, you know, a 12-inch, you know, free shot isn't actually bad.
You just park the Storm Surge right there in the front.
Right. You might be like, okay, no bubble wrap. You know, here are my five Riptides.
If you're Deep Striking anywhere, Storm Surge. Here's who you have to come and talk to.
Right. So that actually forces some intrigue there. Yeah. And if you have, you know, dudes with For the Greater Good a little bit further back from your Storm Surge, then that's a whole lot of, now I guess they probably couldn't do that there because that's only when they're being charged, but
no, yeah, it's when the target is being charged. So if they're within 6 inches of the Storm Surge that's being charged, then they get to do the Greater Good shooting.
That's an interesting, having Big Stumpy as your point man. That's kind of interesting.
I don't know that that's the thing to do. I just know that's where I would begin exploring it, you know.
Let's talk about Mr. Storm Surge, right? Cuz he's got a lot of strength 5 shooting. You can give him, at least in the old days, you can give him AT, I believe it's ATS for the extra -1 AP. So you got a ton of strength 5, maybe -1 AP shots. You got the pulse blast cannon, which is like
ATS, and I want to just expel it out here. That's the advanced targeting system.
With
an advanced targeting system, increases the AP characteristic of all its weapons by 1.
Still got it. So yeah, so you can give him basically a lot of anti-infantry shooting. Even in the old days, I found that the Storm Surge was kind of oddly undergunned in a lot of scenarios. 18
points, the ATS.
That's more spendy than it used to be, I think. But anyway, so if you have him as point man, and if something you're afraid of is, you know, T3, T4 models charging you out of Deep Strike, then, you know, baiting them out and being able to intercept and shoot them really at least twice, you know, if it's once when they come in and then once again as they charge in, if you could somehow set that up, that's kind of not bad.
I think you'll find yourself having to spend a lot of points to commit to this, to like really do it well. But even having that stuff in a little bit is enough to make your opponent think. And you are shooting a volume of shots. Like, well, for instance, what's the missiles? The missiles, I believe.
4d6.
4d6 shots. So strength 5, no AP. But if you've got the advanced targeting system, now you're shooting it at -1 AP. You know, and let's talk about that for just 1 minute, if I can. You know that anytime you change the pips on the dice when you're talking about a D6. Anytime you move it, it's significant. So you're automatically right there wounding 16, almost 17% more often than you were before.
Or less often on the EWO scenario. But the other cool thing is stabilizing anchors. Does that work in things other than the shooting phase?
Typically, that stuff is anytime it shoots, but let's check it out.
You made a pull. Well, I only have the index version here.
No, let's check it out. So the stabilizing anchors, a storm surge may deploy its anchors at the end of your shooting phase. While its anchors are deployed, it may not move for any reason and it cannot pile in and attack in the fight phase. But you can add one to its hit rolls, period.
So that makes it a lot better at shooting things with early warning override.
Yeah, but it just says it may not move, but you can add one to its hit rolls, period. So while its anchors are deployed. So you get a storm surge may deploy its anchors at the end of your shooting phase. So after you've already shot once, you can say, I'm sinking in. While its anchors are deployed, it may not move for any reason, but it cannot pile in. Oh, sorry. And it cannot pile in an attack in the fight phase, but you can add one to its hit rolls.
So the KV-128 Storm Surge might be the Tau's tackling dummy to fire out there. Because another cool thing is it has, or at least it used to have, walking battleship. So if it does get, swarmed by something and, it's shot them up, it's got a, four up invuln. Is there any access to feel no pain at all for it anymore?
I don't believe so.
Was there something, were you guys talking about a stratagem last week? Does that apply to the big suits?
I believe the stratagems do apply to the big suits, and there may be also be a system support upgrade that does it too. I don't want to say no, it's not on its page. I'll just say it's not on its page.
There might be ways to like beef it up and make it a little bit more survivable, but I find that this concept's kind of interesting.
Because injector, I think, is what we're talking about, and that does choose a battle suit, and it is not a battle suit.
It is not a battle suit. So that's another thing too. Is like people, I think, got away from the storm surge and are probably running away from the storm surge now that the Riptide's got so much cheaper and seemingly more effective. But maybe there's an argument that the storm surge kind of can run as a bodyguard to your three or four. Riptides. Maybe the Bash Bros are back.
I hate to hear that. Actually,
automated repair system is pick a vehicle or battle suit, and that model regains D3 lost wounds. And this is a vehicle. Just thinking of ways, just going through. That's a two command point thing. The automated repair system.
Well, he's got 20 wounds. He's on a 4-up save. So what you got to do? 40 wounds to this guy on toughness 7 with his 4-up invuln, assuming you take that, and you always take that. So, he's not a chump,
What are you taking for his 4+ invulnerable save?
Isn't that just the regular, the shield that he used to be able to buy? It used to be 40 points, and you bought it, and it was a 4-up invuln as a system upgrade.
Let me see if it's one of these support systems.
Shield generator, I believe.
Shield generator, yes.
Let's take a look.
It's scary that I know all this stuff.
A model with a shield generator has a 4+ invulnerable save.
There it is.
You cannot take this support system on a Riptide battlesuit. I mean,
because they already have one.
They have their own shield, right? Okay, yep.
So there you go. I don't know, because I think a lot of people wouldn't bother with the storm surge because you can't kick wounds out to drones.
The shield generator on a storm surge is 40 points.
Yeah. So the storm surge immediately just strikes you as a seems to be a worse bet because you can't kick things out to drones. You can't make it super survivable like you can a battle suit. So I would think that a lot of people would still probably, if they were to bring a storm surge, and I think we're just sort of talking about I think everyone's got a storm surge, maybe two.
Hang on,
if you play
a 7. There's also another support system, the counter fire defense system.
Mm-hmm. That's what we're watching fives?
Yeah, well, no.
Oh, my bad.
A model equipped with a counter fire defense system re-rolls failed hit rolls when firing Overwatch.
Not bad.
That's going to get dirty.
So I'm not, look, we're talking up the storm surge, and I think we're talking about all the things you can do with a storm surge. Not, this means that you should run out and get, replace your crew screens with storm surges. I'm not.
Well, but I think the thing is that even in seventh, a lot of people would take the storm surge, and in those days it was definitely a good choice. I'm not saying this is a good choice.
Well, it's not a bad,
and they would,
it's not
and
a
they
bad
would park
choice.
It. And,
we haven't
and they
added
would park
up all
it,
the points.
The thing is, they would park it on the back edge, and it would just stand there, right? Whereas I think the storm surge, even now, even though it's less obvious, it's supposed to be that sort of heavy weapons platform hanging out in the back. It still strikes me as something that's better to have up forward, taking a punch for your army, and doing some short range. you know, tight quarters work.
Yeah, if they are legitimately trying to get rid of the Storm Surge that has 20, is this 20 wounds with a 3+ armor save, you know, heck, maybe you find a way to get it in some cover. I don't know. if you play anywhere that has cover for a Storm Surge, but with a 4+ invulnerable save, it's not going anywhere for a long time, be a tough to 7.
Yeah.
Two turns, baby. At least two turns.
Yeah, I like it, man. I mean, I think it's going to be a good option. Like you said, definitely don't, you know, run to the store and try to buy one based off of this. You know, really put some thought into your list design. I don't think it's going to fit in every list. And
I would say, though, for anyone who's looking at this Tau Codex, and say you are a Tau player, and I mean, let's be honest, guys. I mean, some of the, you kind of owe it to your army to do exactly what we just did.
Well, let's
sit down
about,
with each data slate and like just think, like, how can I use this?
Well, let's
and I think
really
then
think
you might be able
too,
to squeeze some value out of it.
The Yavara that you were talking about. Now, does the Yavara allow you to pick signature systems, or is it just what's in the Forge World, the Forge World Index?
Oh, we got to break the flow chart out for this one.
This keyword minus that keyword plus keyword.
But does it have the option to take, so that's it.
Actually, yes, you definitely. So, well, the words are War Gear options. The Yavara may take up to two items from the support systems list. See Warhammer 40,000 Index Xenos 2. So Index Xenos 2 would be replaced by the Codex now.
So I think that's a logical thing to go. So now let's say you don't want to invest the points of a Storm Surge as your goalie. Now the Yavara with those super flamers with the extra range, the people could drop in from, and they would then not be typically subjected to the early warning override because their weapon would be out of range coming in at 12 inches.
True, but not anymore.
But Borkan or whatever it is, they would get shot up. Several times.
Yeah. I mean, like a pair of Yavaras and a standard Riptide, or even like three Yavaras and a standard Riptide. I don't know how much that costs. It's probably a lot. I think a Yavara, even out of the box, like out of the index, is around 400 points. I have to sort of pull it up here. But, you know, I think you might be seeing the Yavara even more. And it was already sort of in those non-pure commander spam lists. You probably would see the Yavara as one of those more common units. It's a nice one, especially if it pairs well with these new sep traits.
Seps and the new stuff, yeah. And there's a couple other things we haven't talked about yet, too. The Master of War is an ability that your commander can get. Once per battle at the beginning of your turn, a single commander from your army can declare either Kion or Mont Ka. Kion is until the end of the turn, you can reroll failed hit rolls for friendly sept units within 6 inches of the commander, but these units cannot move for any reason.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a huge fan of the not moving in this edition, but I guess if you can find a way to really tool up your shooting phase to where you don't have to move, then that's fine. But I'm telling you, it's really got to be there for you to be able to want to take advantage of this stuff. But rerolling all failed hit rolls is pretty strong. As you know, we see lots of only rerolling ones or whatever's typically.
So if you're looking at Kion from sort of a first turn like perspective, I think that's how I usually wound up using it, was sort of as my opening gambit, an alpha strike type scenario where you've got a bunch of stuff parked and you just want to shoot everything, get your reroll hits. Then I think it kind of works as a sort of a first turn move. And I think that's what it's supposed to symbolize, like the dudes popping up and ambushing. I might be talking out of my butt, though.
Oh, whatever. Sounds good. That was the White Scars campaign, I believe, if I remember right.
Oh, yeah. That's
Kion
that's
what, was, yeah.
Maybe I'm wrong. I might be having this reversed. But then the Mont Ka, friendly SEP units within 6 inches of the commander can both advance and shoot as if they hadn't moved this turn. Said, unless otherwise stated, you can only use the Master of War ability once per battle, irrespective of how many models in your army have this ability. So, you know, we've seen that there's the change here, and you're playing matched play. You can only take one commander per detachment. And this is saying that even if you had three and three different detachments, you could still only use that ability once.
There's a lot of like subtle balancing factors that they did when the way that they carefully worded things. I really like it. And another thing that I really enjoy, you know, as we're progressing through this book more and more, and I don't think I've noticed it before, but you're getting so much diversity in how you can design your list and how you want it to perform with the signature systems, the different weapon platforms. The different septs and stuff like that to really, you can really make an army unique to yourself. And I think that is going to be something in the long run, we're going to see this book get some longevity out of as we can find combos more and more. You know, we're not going to create the greatest list ever tonight, but maybe 6 months from now or a year from now, we might start seeing that. And we are seeing that with the Tyranid codexes. They're getting a little bit more powerful as time has progressed. And I think this book specifically is going to be one like that as well.
If we can see an evolving meta, I love it. I love it when that stuff is happening. I want to talk about one of the stratagems here. And I know we haven't talked a lot about marker lights or how to get marker lights or what has a marker light. I want to talk about the Sky Ray in a moment, but within the context of this uplinked marker light.
Mm-hmm.
This is a stratagem. Use this stratagem after an enemy unit has been hit by a marker light fired by a model from your army. Place D3 plus one marker light counters next to that unit instead of only one. That's one command point.
I love it. That's a great command point.
And the reason that I think that's important is the way the marker lights work now
is it an extra D3 or just D3? It just becomes D3 shot.
D3 plus one.
So it can almost get you all the way to four on a good roll.
Yeah, on a good roll, you're at four. So the way the marker lights work now, and I know we talked about this before, but I'm just doing it for completeness sake here. If a model other than a vehicle fires a marker light, it cannot fire any other weapons in that phase. Also important, other than a vehicle. When a unit is hit by a marker light, place a counter next to it for the remainder of the phase. The table below describes the benefits Tau Empire models receive when shooting at a unit that has marker light counters. All benefits are cumulative. So you get all the way up to four. Then Tau Empire models attacking unit do not suffer the penalty for moving and firing heavy weapons or advancing and firing assault weapons. That's pretty good.
That one's really handy.
No, five or more is add one to hit rolls for all Tau models attacking it. Number three is target unit does not gain any bonus to save and throw for being in cover. Number two, here's the big one. Destroyer and Seeker missiles fired at this unit using the firing models... Destroyer and Seeker missiles fired at this unit use the firing model's ballistic skill and any modifiers rather than only hitting on a six. So let's go to the Sky Ray, if I can.
Please, after you.
The Sky Ray, the TX-78 Sky Ray gunship. It comes with two marker lights and six Seeker missiles. Each Seeker missile can only be fired once per battle. The weapon only hits on a roll of a six, regardless of the firing model's ballistic skill or any modifiers. So since this is a vehicle, it can fire its two marker lights. If you don't get your two hits, you could then pop your the one command point stratagem to get you D3 plus one. You might max it all the way up to five just off of that if you hit with both, if you so choose. But if not, you're definitely going to at least get to two when you hit with the second one. And this thing hits on BS3. If you max out that chart, you're hitting on BS2 and you're firing Seeker missiles, which are 72-inch range. Now, obviously, your marker lights are 36-inch range. You got to be within whatever that range band is.
42 if you're the right set.
Right. And you can move too, right? And your movement is 12 inches on these things. The Seeker missiles are heavy one, strength eight, neg two AP, but they do D6 damage. Pretty potent.
And you got six of those, basically, what, hitting on twos, rerolling ones? Am I right about that?
Yes, you can with the chart itself, yeah. If you had the chart maxed out, if you had five or more marker lights on them.
Which isn't absurd when you have two marker lights on BS3.
Correct.
Not bad. Yep. And you have to have a velocity tracker, if I'm not mistaken, these days. Someone told me that in the pre-show.
You have to get a velocity tracker, yes. So you add one to hit rolls for the for this model when shoots at the units that have fly. So there's lots of scary things with fly that are real bummed about him being hit with six Seeker missiles.
They would be super bummed about getting hit with six Seeker missiles.
Yeah. That's a lot of damage, and not much stands up to that, if anything, really.
Well, you're forcing, like, say, a big model like a Mortarion or, a Magnus or whatever, you're forcing them to go to their invulnerable save. So you're increasing your chance of wounding, and then when you will hit, I mean, especially if you got that maxed out, you will hit with all of them. And then you're going to wound with a couple, and then you're going to be able to convert that to some big damage numbers.
Yeah, and then, the big key in fighting those guys is take them down quickly. And I think that the Tau are going to be able to do that, which I hope kind of, you know, mitigates the meta in that aspect, where we start to see a little bit less Mortarian Magnus lists, and it evens out the field a little bit more, and we start seeing some more diverse lists. But I'm afraid Eldar might actually come up more, but that's another topic.
Well, I think the range on Eldar, sorry to jump in here, Val, is that the range on Eldar, there are very few of them have really super long range. The rest of them are, I mean, you got movement, you can move and stuff, but then it's a slightly different game at that point. But the Tau, they have a lot of 72 and 36 inch, 60 inch range weaponry, or things that can move and cover that distance. And then fire the high rate of fire damage to stuff. So I think they're going to be able to play the shooting game against the Eldar. I think they're going to really suffer in the other phases, though.
Oh, yeah, specifically the psychic phase.
Yeah, that won't be good.
That is the opposite of good. But, you know, things like Yavara, that really will stack up pretty good against Shining Spears when they can't charge it.
One thing that stands out to me with Tau as just sort of an area of concern is their lack of access to mortal wounds. So the Seekers used to be one little dinky mortal wound per hit, which actually was pretty awesome. I actually tried to make a Seeker missile spam list right at the beginning of 8th edition. It didn't go very well. because what happened was they just put a Calexis in front, and I only could I like face an all character army, and I could only target the Calexis with my Seeker missiles.
Your gimmick list meant it's one nemesis.
It was game over, man.
Oh, man.
I tipped my cap. I was like, I did not read that in the rules. Anyway, that is all to say that, like, you know, there used to actually be, through secret missiles and all the things that could take them, a lot of good access to mortal wounds. And there are things that are, you know, going to be vulnerable to those high, you know, strength, high damage attacks. But a mortal wound is like, it's just a wound in most cases. So there's a tremendous amount of value to it. And that's why, you know, people gravitated a lot to smite spam when they could. And, you know, anywhere that you have the opportunity to generate mortal wounds is a really, really good thing. And I think one place to really start reading close in this is, like, where are the mortal wounds that Tau have access to? Don't want to overrate my pal Kevin Costner, the Storm Surge, but, you know, he does have 4d3 mortal wound dealing Devastator destroyer missiles on him. But outside of that, you got sniper drones, maybe, you know, sort of very limited access to mortal wounds. So finding ways to, now that the Seeker missile is gone, where can you get those auto wounds from?
I was looking at the sniper drones, the sniper destroyer drones, whatever they're called. They don't look that bad. You take three of them in a squad, buff them up a bit.
The dude who is actually super handy is actually the drone controller guy that you can sort of take him on his own. What's his name? He's the Firesight Marksman.
Right, okay.
I think he comes with a marker light. Yeah, that's right. So he's basically a 3-up ballistic skill marker light. He has the character rule. He's just a solo infantry dude for 24 points. And so he was a handy guy for just hiding out back somewhere. If you just wanted to get that one marker light
objective or something, yeah.
Yeah, if you just want that one marker light for reroll once, then, you know, that dude's your bro. Although he's, you know, half as expensive as 4 Pathfinders, but
the sniper, the MV-71 sniper drones, base BS-5+, not amazing, but it's a rapid fire 1 48-inch range weapon.
That's pretty sweet.
Yeah, so the weapon might target characters even if not the closest enemy unit. If you make a wound roll of a 6+ for this weapon, it inflicts a mortal wound on the target in addition to its normal damage.
Yeah, and double tapping in 24, you know, like, you know, you should probably not scoff at that. That's a good range
for it.
It's
got an 8-inch move, too. So that's really double tapping at, what, 32 inches.
Yeah, and they also get a bonus to their hit if they're near the Firesight Marksman.
Yeah, so. And these are somewhat survivable, too. You subtract 1 from the hit rolls in the shooting phase for attacks made against this unit, unless it's within 12 inches of the firing model. And they have they've got the savior protocols, meaning that battle suits and stuff can dump wounds to them. And they have for the greater good. So,
yep. What did you say the points cost on them were
again? The long shot pulse rifle is their weapon, and I believe that is 0 points. And so, what did I call them? The MV-17? What is it? MV-71. My apologies. 18 points per model, and the long shot pulse rifle is 0 points.
Yeah, that's not bad. And you have to take what? You said up to 3 or...
In that squad,
yeah,
it contains 3 of them. You can include an additional 3 or up to 6 additional.
That's not a lot of points, really, for kind of a good unit to move around, harass, dump shots.
They're lead 6 with a 4+ save.
All right, never mind.
You don't want to put them in a situation where they're picking up models. You know, but I'm sure there's ways to buff. I mean, there's ways to get around that stuff. I mean, they do have the Tau Empire keyword, and they do have the set keyword. So, you know, stuff's gonna factor into that. Let me talk about a couple of these relics, if you don't mind.
Some good guns.
Well, the seismic destabilizer. Now, remember, a relic is free. So everybody gets, or every army gets one relic at no cost. No point cost, unless it replaces something, but they typically replace something minimal. Or unless you want to spend more command points, you can get more. But the seismic destabilizer, I think it's a pretty good pick for your free one. At the start of each shooting phase, you may pick an enemy infantry unit claiming the benefit of cover, or a building within 12 inches of the bearer. If you picked a building, it suffers D3 mortal wounds. If you picked an infantry unit, roll a dice for each model in the unit. For each roll of a 6, that unit suffers a mortal wound.
That just happens every turn?
Every turn. At the start of each shooting phase, pick something.
That's not so bad. There you go. There's some mortal wounds.
It's got to be within 12 inches, though. So you have to, I mean.
Gold Star Commander?
Yeah, but it's at the start of the shooting phase, so you can get over there. Get within 12 and do it.
I think that that's going to get some play. I mean, you're going to be aggressive with some of your suits and your suit commanders. So I really see that this is going to dish out some wounds. This is probably going to be a more popular choice, I believe.
Well, you kind of have to imagine, though, that people are going to try to get in the cover against your army because you're going to be throwing a lot of bullets at them.
Well, thankfully, there's like hardly any cover out there, so.
Well, there's more and more every tournament. People step it up.
And it's just something getting the benefit of cover, right?
Yes, but to get the benefit of the cover, you got to be fully in, and
not necessarily. There's a Tau sept that gives you the benefit of cover for just being that sept. There's a Tyranid Hive Fleet, Jormungandr, that gives you the benefit of cover for just standing around. So there are things
claiming the benefit of cover. That's all you have to be.
Yeah. So
yeah, what a hard counter. Pushing. What a spoiler if you just like walking around, I claim the benefit of the cover even in open ground. Well, you're getting destabilized.
I'll take these on sixes. Sorry, unit of 30 Termagants.
Hey.
There goes my secret list. My Jormungandr list is done.
That's picking up 6.5 Termagants or whatever.
Yeah, seriously. So on those big units or those bomb units, like it could certainly come in handy. Because again, you only have, you know, you got to do your damage either while you're being charged or just before you get charged. So really anything you can do to take a few wounds off is fantastic.
Yeah, I do like this. This is more of a gimmicky thing, but the solid image projection unit. It's for an ethereal. It's ethereal with hover drone only, actually. Once per phase, when an enemy unit declares the bearer as a target of a charge, you may move the bearer up to 3 inches before the charge roll is made.
I like it. It's funny.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Like, oh, how much do you need? 8-inch charge? 11.
Well, think about, what if it's already 11 and you move out to, you know, then you move out to 14 inches away, then they couldn't have even declared the charge in the first place.
Ooh, yep.
Then you play Justin Timberlake and Cry Me a River.
There is something called a supernova launcher. Models with an air bursting fragmentation projector only. The supernova launcher replaces one of the model's air bursting projectors. It has the following profile: 18-inch assault D6, strength 6, -2 AP and 2 damage apiece, and it can fire indirect.
Oh, suck!
I like the fire and indirect. I don't like the 18 inches, but I like the fire and indirect. Yeah, yes. The reason I'm questioning some of these range bans, because it's like you've got to build the army that isn't going to move a lot, probably because you want to get all the extra shots, so you don't really want to be close to anybody.
That's true, but I mean, not to overstate it too much, but there's a lot of weird ranges that Tau has. They have stuff that's in that 18 inches, or in like. They'll have like a 30-inch range. But now you've got that extra 6 inches all over the place. And I think it actually does make a big difference in a lot of cases. And that would be one of them. Like there's something more comfortable about being 24 inches away rather than 18 inches. Kind of takes you out of, you know, being in easy charge range. You're
funneling everyone to that one set, though, at that point.
Yeah, I think it's the best one. A little popular for sure. Yeah. I mean, I haven't gone over them all. I have to go back through all the community articles and stuff, but or just wait for my codex in a few days. Can't wait. You know, I suspect that one really does give, because again, like you're saying, if you can't participate in the assault phase, you've got to mitigate it as best you can. And one of the best ways to do that is just keep things at range from yourself. And the same thing actually goes for the psychic phase. A lot of the worst stuff in the psychic phase is actually pretty close range as far as offensive stuff. Smite's 18 inches. Even a lot of spells that are cast on you that are debuffs outside of Eldar, which can extend their casting range. A lot of times it's going to be in that 18 to 24 inch range band. So you can try and protect yourself by building in a little bit of buffer space, a little bit of room to maneuver.
I think that's what the Tau have to focus their efforts in the army list phase on, army list design phase, is like, how do you make that 24 inches between you and the enemy a true no man's land?
You put a storm surge named Kevin Costner in it.
Yeah.
You're supposed to laugh. I think that's a joke. Oh. I think it's a joke.
Oh, well, and I thought you were just that's not a bad play. I thought you were naming it something important to you.
Yeah, the bodyguard.
Canadian hero.
It's a bodyguard reference. And then all of your riptides are Whitney Houston.
I was going Waterworld because of the fish thing, so I'm way off.
Oh, wow. That's even better.
I was like, Dances with Tuna? I'm just saying.
Okay. Paul Murphy is Dennis Hopper. Yes.
I'm only saying that you really have to focus on making that a no man's land with your shots. And you really, right now, with the way it's, there's only one, most armies only have one assault unit that you really have to worry about. And if you gear yourself up to crack that one assault unit, then nothing else is going to get close enough to you, I think. So maybe you can outshoot people and compensate for your lack of psychic power and offensive and assault phase capability.
Realistically, like, let's say you're bottom of one and you've got to take all of this stuff, against the higher powered shooting lists, against even like your day one of 8th edition Gilliman gunline style thing. Is there enough defense in some of the units that you're going to want to take as a Tau player to even be able to survive to that?
Well, if I can get like super granular, a lot of the stuff in the Gilliman gunline specifically is 24 to 36 inch range.
Mm-hmm.
Most things being 20, like assault cannons, 24 inch plus the move. They're going to get in range and they're going to get a lot of converts, but they are slightly less effective, forcing them to have more rerolls. And so you are at least positioned better than other armies that are relying on getting close to them and not forcing them to move at all.
Right. It's an open question. I am curious because, I don't know if you guys remember, but when Eldar dropped, I guess even to an extent Tyranids, I think, was universally hailed as awesome. But certainly when Eldar dropped, people weren't too keen about it.
Oh, yeah.
And I really hope that there is a genius out there that's going to find some super cool stuff that everyone overlooked could wreck face.
The counterpoint here is that you're looking at it and what you're not seeing is a unit of Dark Reapers. The army does not have a unit of Dark Reapers that get to fire twice every turn. It doesn't have that. No codex has that outside of Eldar.
Mm-hmm.
This might be a more fair codex.
And I'm hopeful here. Maybe I'm terribly wrong. It's because Tau already have some stuff that we take for granted built in. And hopefully, maybe with some of the points decreases and, some of those stratagems, the power level is there. We just haven't gotten it on the table to experience yet.
I brought it up at the beginning of the show, and this actually got told to me by a buddy who also listens. He's like, oh, that point decrease in those suits, it's like a free squad for every one of those point decreases. So if you were taking them anyway, your army just got some percentage bigger because you're able to take full complete squads with these point reductions and do something with them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. When you're talking about a Riptide and a squad of Fire Warriors, versus just a Riptide,
your greater good just got better.
Yeah. Now you have your greater goods. You have a small screen if you need to, or whatever the case may be. You have objectives secured. There's so many different factors to layer in, and the more the combos that start coming out that are going to start nullifying some of the defensive combos that we see on things right now, Tau, I think, are going to be able to pick apart armies very well. And then it's just finding a way to mitigate that psychic phase. It's finding a way to mitigate that assault phase.
Yeah, you got
to
kill that psyker. Maybe you take 150 points of sniper drones.
Yeah.
Or 180 points. You take 10 sniper drones and hope for the best.
Or two squads of Vespids and just go hunting.
No one's getting the Vespids.
No, it's not catching on.
You never know. I don't want to say no, especially if you're going with that sept that allows them to get the greater good.
You know what they need to do, honestly, is resculpt them and make them look like super awesome. Don't change the rules at all.
I think they look okay right now. Val, I think you were good to bring up the Forge World stuff. When we're doing codex reviews, people sometimes give us a little bit of grief by bringing in Forge World, but I think it's always relevant because they are part of the game. I understand that those books come out from a technically separate entity, but it is very much part of the game that we play on the competitive side of things.
And I'm kind of sad because I'm prepping for ETC format where they don't even let you bring index entries once there's a codex, let alone Forge World. You know, I won't get to play with any of these toys, but I really do wonder if, you know, certainly in a ITC or, you know, even in sort of your Warzone format events, that if Tau doesn't become very Forge World focused, because there's also other things in the Imperial Armor book here that maybe I don't even know very well. You were already seeing a few different of the Crisis Suit variants coming around. I really particularly loved the Remora drones, again, for those secret missile shots. They could deep strike. They had a lot of heavy burst, burst cannon shots. They were just a lot of fun to run around with a Cold Star Commander. Maybe that could still be a lot of fun to do. So, you know, there's going to be options there, that will be, you know, fun to have a look at and point out and see if, you know, some of those sept traits might favor the units that are available in the index.
I think
because there is an extensive, range for Tau that come from Forge World.
I think we're just scratching the surface as far as what the Codex can and can't do. I mean, we haven't, you know, we personally haven't even read out or gone through all the combos with all the stratagems and the sept combinations and the Warlord trait combinations and what have you. But again, it's just kind of nice to be able to talk about. I never thought I might say this, but it's kind of nice to talk about them in a what could be competitive stance. And I mean, just what I see right now at tournaments, that they, a lot of lists, especially a lot of winning lists, have like a singular forward element, if they have the forward element at all. And I think the Tau have the tools to at least deal with that. Not that people can't evolve and change things or whatever. But the real question is, can they get by not surviving in the psyche phase? And can they outshoot somebody who's a dedicated shooter?
I just want to fire out a food for thought. I get the sense you might be trying to segue, but I really want to fire this one out there. The TX-7 Fire Support Hammerhead Gunship. So it's a variant of the regular old Hammerhead. You can bring it with a twin heavy burst cannon. So with the points drop and the increase to the benefits of the burst cannon, would that make this a better option?
I'd be very curious. Is it double the shots? Is that what it is?
Well, actually, as I'm saying this out loud, it's actually the entry is twin heavy burst cannon. Right. So then I guess that doesn't change. The twin heavy burst cannon is different from two heavy burst cannons. Do you know what I mean? Because this one's heavy 16, strength 6, -1 damage.
No, that's just what it is. It's just added.
So yeah, it wouldn't actually benefit.
Well, okay, that's a different. It might have added shots to the old profile. So it's probably in need of a updated profile because the heavy
burst cannon errated.
Is now 12 shots. And I think it was fewer shots before.
I think it might have been heavy 8.
Yeah.
But what I'm saying with that is, like, that's on a Hammerhead gunship, so it's got ballistic skill 3, can be buffed by long strike, and you got that, you know, -1/2 damage gun. Is that a better chassis than a Riptide potentially? I don't know. We got to look, you know, that's the kind of stuff that the Forge World options give you. Yeah. So all the places where the weapons changed, you know, there's lots of different Forge World stuff that can take that weapon that maybe is better than what you'd be able to take from the Codex. So it's worth going for a dig and a root around.
Absolutely. Well, that's a good place to stop. We're going to wrap up part two here of this Tau coverage. If you haven't already, please subscribe. Give us a big thumbs up, a 5-star rating here, a like or a comment or whatever. It's really nice to hear people that play these armies, like on the, like this is their main army, getting their comments about what you want to see, what you're curious about, what you're taking in your list. That's the kind of stuff we love to hear. So please telegraph that, you know, somehow either in a message to us off our website, ForgeTheNarrative.net, or on the YouTube comments, or heck, even in an iTunes review or whatever, or comment on Podbean, wherever you listen to us, feel free to engage, and we're happy to hear it. You guys have a good rest of y'all's night.
Keep your knife sharp.
Thanks a lot, Paul. Have a great night.
FTN is brought to you by Bell of Lost Souls. Check out www.bols.org for the best daily hobby articles on the web.
Hey everybody, we are back. It is going to be neat to see how the Tau fit into people's tournament list and what they're going to take. I like some of the changes And I do like, I think it's kind of interesting to think that you could use the Storm Surge as a goalie, as opposed to just a complete backfield on the back of the table type thing.
I really just want to see somebody like modify that, so those dinky Storm Surgers are holding like a hockey goalie stick.
If they put arms to that thing, it would have been so cool.
Those are some of my favorite conversions, is to see what people do to those Storm Surgers to bring arms to bear. Oh. You know, you see a lot of like Iron Man, Hulkbuster suits and stuff like that.
It looks cool as it is. Especially, I like that white color scheme has grown on me, where it's the white with the brown recess shading and the
I love chips. It.
And the red spot colors.
Yeah, it's grown on me. Grown
hands
on
down, the best looking towel color scheme out there, I think. I could never pull it off because of the white
ones. Yeah. Absolutely.
That original ochre color was pretty terrible.
Yeah, my favorite is still like the smoky gray with bright blue accents.
Someone recently sent in some pictures to the show where it's a gray and a yellow. It's very similar to one of the ones that was, now the color scheme is similar to the one that was featured from the LVO coverage on the GW Twitch stream. It's just a striking contrast of colors, and it just to get fabulously executed. They're gray looking army. A color scheme I would have not have thought to do gray and yellow, but apparently it's pretty good for the towel.
Little red scorpion action.
Yeah, you do the black and yellow, and then everyone's like, ah, bumblebees. So you just got to water down that black a little bit.
Or some bumblebees Steelers.
Bumblebees are cool, too.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. I did a scout company in black and yellow one time. Now, this was done a long time ago, so in my mind, it looked a lot better.
Those are the Horus Heresy's Templar colors, are black and yellow.
Yeah.
Angry little hornets building their hives.
I dig it. The finishing moves I want to talk about is making things look like ghosts. You know, this is using the Nihilus Oxide over white and Celestial Gray to make things look spectral and that kind of wispy and immaterial type stuff. And this is coming, like, you see this used in other places. Like, I've used it on the Sylvaneth to make the tree spirits look spirity. You can use it on undead, like the range, like the Banshee and that kind of stuff. And a lot of people use Nihilus Oxide, and I like the Nihilus Oxide look, but it seems like it has a little bit of texture to it. And I know that's what it's supposed to have, but it seems a little gritty. Is that y'all's experience also?
Mine is super thin. Yeah, I've seen some in there, but when I did my son's undead army, his spirit host and all that, I mixed Nihilic Oxide and Lamian Medium did that over the white primer. And I mean, that was pretty much it. Primed it white, mixed up the oxide with the medium, and just sloshed her on there pretty good. And, you know, 20 minutes later, he had an army.
Well, in my opinion, you don't want to slosh it on there.
No. I mean, go. Yeah. Like, you know, when you're throwing Nuln Oil on a bolter and you can just kind of go to town, this you're going to guide it a little more. I kind of like to do it with a bigger brush, like a shade brush. If you take like the large shade brush, because it's got more coverage and it will spread it more evenly, you'll get a better spread of over the model, so you don't see so many brush strokes and lines and stuff, even with that medium.
Not getting the brush strokes is pretty key there. And I found that this wash, it's not, I don't even know if it's a true wash or not. This product, you can pull it with the brush a little bit easier. And what I mean by literally pulling it is like, it'll pull up a little bit and you can take the tip of the brush and drag that color where you want it to go easier than a lot of the other colors out there.
Yeah. We talk about this one a lot. And one of the things I find very common when doing ghost-like effects is oftentimes we only see the one color. You know, it's always a sort of off teal light color. And when I think of ghosts and things, I don't necessarily always want to see that. I kind of want to see some color transitions or something to make it seem less teal and more ethereal and transparent.
What are the color of the fantasy ghost in your world, Chris?
Well, that depends on what they're haunting. But
I asked that question like I don't have an opinion of my own. I just wanted to say
I like the idea of it being environmentally based. So like, say you have something, like say you put your ghosts on a lava base, for example, where you have the reddish glow of the ground around them of reflecting light up on the bottom, just to bring some of the warmer tones in there and just make it even a little bit more unsettling, as opposed to just having a stark, glowy something over green fields or whatever it's going to be. Like I think there are a few creative ways you can bring a little bit more color into it and not just necessarily fall back on, you know, the Return of the King Army of the Dead.
But Chris, arguably the Return of the King Army of the Dead was one of the greatest scenes involving ghosts in cinematic history. I mean, how could you not want to bring that to the tabletop in some way?
You know, sometimes we just need to be heroes, Ricky, and not just be trendy.
Okay.
Especially, well, it depends on, if you're painting a whole army that way, then I think that some variation is, you'd have to, otherwise you'd drive yourself insane, and your army would look kind of one-dimensional from the other side of the table.
Right, so like bring some contrast into it. You could use blending in with some purples and doing things like that, or if you wanted to warm it up a little bit, you could bring some yellows into it. There's a bunch of different ways you can do it, and if you are doing a ton of them and you want them to look more than just a blob on the table, you got to pick it out a little bit more.
Well, where I'm going with that is, I don't know if warm up is the right way, but there are different ways to skin that cat. I shouldn't say the right mentality. You don't necessarily warm up the dead. I could be wrong. Whatever. But
I kind of want to go. Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, go ahead.
But what I was going to say is, I don't really want to, like how Chris was talking, like bring those colors up into the ghost to kind of give it more of a translucent look. I kind of like the idea of taking those cooler ghost, the etherealness, and almost make it look like it's glowing, like the light's coming from them, and to shine that down onto the base. So bring those colors down onto the base and bring those blues down onto the ground to give that effect that it's glowing. And I think that's a really cool option as well.
Yeah, that does sound pretty cool. I mean, and again, it's all about creating contrast. I mean, that's how we have definition with anything, is you want to have some kind of contrast on there. So however you're bringing that into the model, and this will depend very heavily on the type of model that you're painting. I haven't seen what you're working on, Paul, but a lot of times when you see something that's ghostly or ghastly, it's got a lot of torn looking robes and things, and it seems like a wasted opportunity not to take all those crevices and do something interesting with them to make them stand out a little bit more on the table.
That's a good point too. And if you don't get too creative with the skin tone, then you can get creative with the things that people may take for granted on the model. I like that. And where I was kind of going with that, or the comment is that you've got to have somewhere to go. Like, you can't just throw on the wash, no matter what you use, whether it's the baby blue or a darker blue or purple or yellow. I kind of like the suggestion of the yellow from you guys, but you've got to have somewhere to go with it. So if you do that just over white, then you're going to have a hard time highlighting that up to you may overbrush the wash also. Like, you want to be able to clean up and highlight it. So I that celestial gray, you see this, and I think people I think sometimes it's kind of taken for granted that just a white will do, or just a Codex Gray. What's Codex Gray called now?
Administratum Gray, I think.
Yeah, that's good enough, but this, I don't think that it is. I think that this Celestial Gray is kind of the secret sauce here, putting it down and giving you somewhere to go with your highlights, going up to that pure white with a highlight after you've put your base coat on and applied your wash.
Yeah, it works real well. Don't forget though that if you do go with just white, the Lamia, or not the Lamia, but the Nihilic, if you're doing that technique, if you're washing over it with a Nihilic oxide or whatever, that will bring the color down a bit. So dry brushing over that with a white, or edge highlighting with a white, will come through. But yeah, I think you're definitely right there that you'll get more out of it if you go with a darker color. But
well,
I would definitely
gray's not very dark. It's just not white.
Exactly. It's just a darker shade. It's just any of those, just a tiny bit that when you look at it by itself, you don't really notice it. But paint them side by side on something, and then look at it, and some of those colors you can really tell the difference once you see them side by side.
It's the same thing you see like Duncan using Palo Witch Flesh all the time. You're like, well, my tan's good enough.
Yeah, I literally just picked up Palo Witch Flesh because I couldn't remember the name that I was wanting to talk about. But yes, Palo Witch Flesh looks white. If I'm just holding it right here.
You highlight another color with it, exactly. Then white wouldn't be good enough.
So yeah, I would definitely you know, Pallid Witch Flesh has a bit of a tan in it. Like,
yeah, I'm not saying it's for ghosts. I'm saying that these colors that you kind of take for granted that are very similar to other colors that you're just using as a base coat, like that base coat really matters.
Oh, yeah.
And it's worth it, especially if you've been, you know, if you're looking for something to get, like your hobby, you haven't exhausted your hobby budget on some of these cool figures coming out, get one of these pots of paint that you wouldn't normally pick up.
Yeah, and we were talking earlier about like Necromunda and Kill Team and all that stuff, and little skirmish type games like that where you're just going to paint, you know, 5-10 models. That's where you can really have some fun experimenting with this type of stuff as well. Heck, even Shadespire, you know, when you're painting your Warband and Shadespire, you can try stuff like that and you know, really spread. Yeah, everybody, everything's a ghost. But and you know, some people poo-poo that you know, using the white nylon oxide and then dry brush technique. Okay, I mean, I get it. Yeah, that person didn't spend nearly as much time as you did on your models, but I will bet you money that almost everybody out there that does that technique spends more time on their base work than anybody else does, because when you have that much free time left over, because you've pretty much painted your model in about your army in an hour, you've got how much time devoted to your bases. And I mean, anytime you look at these ghost armies, their bases look amazing. So I don't fault them one bit. I think the bases are what makes a lot of these ghostly armies.
Well, what got me thinking about this was that I'm trying to paint a ghost or an undead something. I haven't quite decided how I'm going to do it, but I was thinking about, okay, I want them to have like weathered shields, and I want to use the nylon oxide technique on their skin to make them look like, you know, ghostly specter we're talking about, but like, how do I make it look different? Like, how do I give them brass shields with this oxidation and use Nylex oxide on their skin and have it not all look the exact same? Like, is that even possible? And I'm like, oh, the base coats.
Does it work? I need to know. Does it work?
Yeah, it does. You're going to get different end games. Now, I think that I might ultimately like add in a little bit of Nolan Oil to the recesses of the metal stuff, where the, because again, I don't actually care how stuff oxidizes in my fantasy world. Like in the 41st millennium, or in this world. Well, in the world, you know, where like ghosts rise up and fight with swords and shields, maybe things rust a little bit differently.
That's silly. Maybe. Science.
Well, okay, if you say so, but I'm telling you, you don't have to be.
I'm not going to take a hardline approach like Ricky here. I don't want to get controversial. I do want to point out that part of selling the paint job are the subtle cues that people can relate to. Oh, that's what this is doing. That's how this is working. And you know, you could make that oxidizing, you could call it ectoplasm, you can call it whatever you want, but intelligent application of those techniques can really help sell the look to whoever's viewing it a lot better.
That's fair. That's a very fair question. I hate to disappoint you and those like you, but I put rust on my brass for my Nurgle tanks. Orange.
It doesn't matter, you know. I mean, it's, if it looks good and you know it conveys that idea, you know, you really gotta I guess have nothing better going on in your day to like really
when you're talking about what's the best that day, you know, it will become subjective, and that may be what it comes down to is like, well, that I'm gonna give that dude the points, but when I'm deciding who's the best, this guy rusted his stuff in the right way.
This is clearly aluminum. What is he doing?
Yeah. I mean,
maybe if you don't do it like that, they're not going to mark you as fully painted on the painting rubric.
I'm not trying to go. I'm not trying to bring that back. Not a callback to that.
But I am.
Right. Well, what I am saying though is that yes, your point is very valid, Chris. That some it just resonates with people. And but I don't even know if everyone is an expert on how things oxidize. But we kind of know that brass gets verdigris and gold really doesn't rust, and that steel rusts orange. Like, are we all comfortable with that?
I am.
Well, Nurgle rusts things orange no matter what it is.
Just one more reason to hate Nurgle.
Right, that just mess up everything. But that's what got me thinking. I'm like, I want to paint these. I'm going to get super nerdy here for a second. Because he's like, these figures are, they're not what they are. They're undead. They've been raised up. And I don't want them with their traditional Spartan colors. I want them to be like purples and blacks and stuff. And I'm like, I'm going to blow your, I didn't tell him what I was going to do, but I'm going to blow his mind. With this spectral skin.
That's a bold mission statement.
I mean, you could pull that off. If you have like a black transitioning to a purple to a light blue, and you add, glowing blue eyes or whatever that are done in that sort of ethereal style that draws the attention to the face, or and you could even for those darker areas do spot highlights, like flick a brush on it to create some dots, almost make it look like stars or like something shining out of the void or something. You could get really creative and make it look really good. That doesn't just involve the one palette of that teal.
Yeah, I like what you're saying there, and I think this will end up being a little bit more basic than flicking a void pattern, but that is something you can do, and that's not hard to do.
No, that was Paul's speech where you had a terrible idea, Chris.
It's not a terrible idea. It's not going on these figures.
Yeah. That's where my toothbrushes go to die. Is those become what? Those become my brushes. My paint
that
start.
That speckle effect is. It's easy. It's hard to master, but it's attainable.
Yeah. When we started, when X-Wing started getting big, I made a bunch of tables. Instead of buying those mats, I just went to Home Depot, got some 3x3 MDF, and took a toothbrush, painted on black, took a toothbrush, and sat down there and flicked until my thumb got tired, and I had like 6 gaming tables built. Love that effect.
Yeah, but I think of how to transition the different, like using this effect for something that is obviously traditionally or at least intended to be used for weathering, to use it on a spirit type effect, and then how do you reconcile needing to weather something with that effect on the figure? And to take us back into the main topic is that it really does come down to the base coats and how you apply it. Like with a verdigris, you're applying it in a different way than you are doing it with the eyes or a mouth or something or whatever on a figure. It's a different application altogether. And then again, to take us back to the technique, is that this stuff, you really can move it and pull it around with the brush, in my opinion, a little bit easier. And I don't know if that's just the consistency of the texture of my particular pot or this paint in general, than you can even Agrax Earthshade and Nuln Oil and our new favorite Athonian Camo Shade, which are all miracle products.
Yep. I'm still looking. I'm trying to get you like one of those NASCAR racing suits with just Athonian Camo Shade on it.
Oh, I'd wear it.
Yeah. I'd be offended if you didn't. If I put that much work into it.
And one of the captions was like, don't worry, the camo shade's on the tracks. Look, changed my life.
It did. Like, man, it's like people find religion and you found camo shade.
We'll go ahead and wrap up. I know we've talked about the spirit effect before, but I really like what Chris brought in with getting way different feelings and possibly working in maybe an environmental type shine to what you're doing to make it stand out and be different. Especially if you're doing an army of ghosts, you are going to want things to be a little bit different and go kind of off the map using, I think, pastel. I think any pastel color you're going to use is going to be all right, if you ask me.
Yeah. Contrast is the name of the game.
Yeah, I think that's good. All right, well, guys, that's our show. You guys got anything else you want to cover before we get out of here?
Let's just say House Escher is the best, and if you play Goliath, you're a loser, I think. There, I said it.
Well, if anybody's playing 30K at Adepticon, be sure to come over and say hi on Saturday. I'll be bringing the Blood Angels back. It's been 2 years since I played 30K at Adepticon. I'm very excited. I may also try and get in on the 40K championships just as a walk-in. I hopefully will be able to play some games with some listeners there.
That sounds awesome. Of course, next week is Adepticon. I'm going to be doing a lot of traveling coming up, so we're going to try to record when we can. We're going to have lots more more content coming. Hold tight. We'll see y'all next week.
Cheers.
Good night.
Why is the rum gone?